cuts, whispered Pentandra. That sounds gorgeous, offered Master Guri with a smug grin. It is one of the greatest wonders of our realm. Unless the Gavania feel like swimming and dodging arrows in the water, they pose no threat to Aratas.
But what about our other opponent?
Lord Letheran's great citadel of Anas Yatharel is in the Kulines, near to the Pearwoods, a secluded vale requiring leagues of hard travel to reach overland, with a strong and fast fortress. One of the mightiest still standing from our glorious past. He is next nearest the Shadow, but he sees the shadows of humanity equally as dreadful.
With the Pearwoods clans for neighbours, I can almost understand that.
The rest of the day was spent sightseeing, as Ithalia took us on a little tour of Carnaduin. It was simply a magical place, the sort of place where you would expect just about any sort of delight to spring from the ground, or float by on the air, just to amuse you. That evening, after being given a chance to refresh ourselves in the guest houses, we were summoned to the reception Ithalia spoke of. It was held in the same building, but in a much larger hall. This one seemed designed for sweet songs, impassioned stories, and cozy discussions. The music was, to my surprise, instrumental, with five Avalanti musicians playing a variety of string and horn instruments I'd never even seen before. I wandered around the room a little, getting a feel for it, and examining the refreshments. Most of the room was crowded with Alka alone, but there were a few humans. We stood out.
Min, there's someone you have to meet,
Pentandra sent to me, mind to mind, as I nibbled on a flower from the buffet table. Yes, a flower.
Who? The Minister of Floral Arrangements? Because he did a hell of a job, I quipped. The sweet liquor I'd chosen was hitting my stomach, and I was fawning over a glorious living sculpture, or serving presentation, in the hall made up entirely of flowers. People were eating them, and they were delicious. But I'll have to yell for him. All of these Alka look alike.
No, you won't. He's easy to spot. He's human.
Since there were only a few of us in the Hall of Hospitality, that helped.
Which one? And why?
The dark and handsome one with the cleft chin and the cheekbones and the hungry look in his eye. Dark, slightly wavy hair, surprisingly delicate ears. He had really good-looking hands, too. Rough, but not too rough. His eyes...
I'm a man, Pentandra, remember? The green cloak or the robe, and why?
Green cloak. The Kasari Ranger. As to why...
Because when he came up behind me a few moments ago, he mentioned that he wished to speak a moment with my master.
Oh, that's all.
Besides him calling you my master.
He smelled like evergreens,
she added dreamily.
Cedar, not pine. And those eyes.
I'll see if I can have words with him. Would you like me to send for a towel? The man in the green cloak at the other end of the room towered over our hosts as much as I did, but he seemed far more comfortable about it. He drank mead from his great waxed horn, while he spoke to several Alka Alon, who all seemed to know him. He looked up and caught my eye, alerted by some preternatural sense. He stared at me a moment, then grinned and excused himself as he made his way over. I first heard about them, the Rangers, not the Kasari people, in Flaris. A troop of them spearheaded the infiltration of the city's landward side, and a group of us from the Magical Corps were detailed to go to the vanguard of the column and cast various spells to assist. I got the task of magically cloaking the lead ranger patrol against scrying. Since the rangers were supposed to eliminate the sentries guarding the city, it was considered an important task. There were 9 of them in this patrol. They were tall. Dua men, who nonetheless remained extremely polite and patient as I prepared them. Their garb was nearly identical, not just tabards, as other fighting units frequently contrived, but all their clothing. They wore tunics and breeches of light green hemp cloth, with their rank and honours embroidered upon the breasts and shoulders in distinctive patterns. Around their waists they wore wide leather belts, from which hung all manner of pouches and pockets. Their boots were sturdy leather, with hardened soles designed for long journeys. They each wore a rolled neckcloth around their necks, fastened with a simple brooch. But their cloaks are what tell a Kasar ranger out.
They're ankle length, made of some special wool from their mountain pastures that seems to repel water, and each bears a long hood that acts as cowl or hat. The cloaks are dyed a mottled dark green and black, and across the back of them were sewn triangular patches across the shoulders, the point facing down. Their rank and unit insignia were sewn in a circle in the center of the triangle, and if thrown back, the hood obscured the whole thing, leaving them virtually invisible in the forest. The neckcloths and the triangles were the only colorful part of their garb. Each man wore a broad steel blade about 20 inches long at their hip, and a few carried other weapons. Then there were their distinctive bows. They used longbows, but not just any war bow. They were more sophisticated than even the Wilderlands bows of the north, though they were similar. Huge springs of hickory and yew, expertly laminated together and strung. I was told they did not fire in volleys, like ordinary bowmen. They were snipers. Their reputation was that they were able to bend a bow and hold the position without moving for hours, and then let fly at a distance with uncanny accuracy. They could stalk and track better than any in the Alshari Wilderlands. It was said that when one of the counts of the region tried to parcel off some of their sacred groves and give it out to his cronies a few generations ago, the armies he sent to capture their mountain fortress was defeated. The count's men were silently picked off by the hundreds along the wooded roadway to their citadel. The beasts of the wood seemed to fight on the side of the Kasari. By the time the force arrived, it was so hopelessly outnumbered that it lay down arms and sued for terms. When I think of the Wilderlands, I don't think of Wilderlords like Sire Kusi was, or even Sire Kay, as rough and tumble as those Narasi Wilderlands knights are. It is those dour, steely-eyed Kasari rangers I think of. I recall looking up at one while I cast spells on his boots. "Why didn't they send more than one patrol of you?" I had asked the ranger, mystified. "There have to be at least 100 sentries out there." "There's only one war," he shrugged with utter confidence. "Why would we need more than one patrol?" True to their word, all 9 of them came back the next morning, and every sentry guarding the city gate was dead. I'd like to think that it was our deftly cast spell work that did it, but I know in my heart that the Kasari didn't give a damn if we cloaked them or not. They would have gotten the job done simply because they were Kasari. Over the years, I'd learned more about them, even encountering a few in my travels as an itinerant war mage. They sometimes travelled in small groups, usually by foot, but sometimes by wagon, between their far-flung groves, all over the Kastali and Alshari wilderlands. I found the Kasari a fascinating people. They aren't secretive about their culture, the way some tribes like the Kalrom or the Maki are, but they are definitely private about its details, assured that no one but another Kasari would understand them. The Kasari were strange. They were neither imperial nor Narasi, but had lived in the forests of the wilderlands long before either culture explored there. But they aren't your average primitive tribal culture either. For one thing, they are all literate. They learn to read old Purwanese and Narasi as part of the rites they undergo as youth. Even though they have their own private language as a people that few outside of their groves ever learn, they were all conversant in both Narasi and Purwanese. As a culture, their people continuously train and learn. They were herders and hunters, not grain farmers. They had no peasants and kept no serfs or villeins, nor did they raid their neighbors for slaves or cattle, as many mountain tribes do. In my subtle research, I had found that the Kasari are essentially a primitive but highly ordered meritocracy, where personal honor and rank are determined purely by skill and achievement. Training is the entire focus of the Kasari culture, training and protecting those sacred groves of theirs. While they use a complex totemic system of animals, instead of worshipping regular human gods, they're quite rational about issues of rank and achievement. They mark their accomplishments in all manner of trades and skills on sashes worn for ceremonial occasions. Every Kasari man and woman trains for their defense, but while they're skilled fighters, they aren't particularly militaristic or warlike. They don't fight each other. The culture of the Kasari revolves around a deep reverence for nature that can border on the pathological.
The focus of their culture is rooted in their adolescent rites, in which young men and women are secluded in the deep Kasari forests and instructed in their sacred codes and other teachings. Over the course of years, they learn additional skills in their mysteries, which involve secret trials and ordeals of courage. They emerge as extremely skilled scouts. Beyond puberty, they can elect to go forth into the world and practice a trade, or otherwise seek their fortune, or they can decide to stay within the Kasari regions. If they stay, their marriages are arranged with a suitable match, and they are settled within one of their remote communities. Periodically, they return to the sacred groves and practice their mysteries with their children. Culturally speaking, their honor was legendary. If a Kasari made you a promise, he kept it, or he died trying. Their codes were sacrosanct. They prompted them to do kind deeds every day and valued personal honor and achievement. They emphasized service, personal honor, and a host of other virtues most religions pay lip service to but never quite live up to. While most people see such things as lofty ideals, the Kasari practiced their code with religious devotion. In order for a Kasari youth to become an adult, there were sweeping areas of knowledge and lore they were expected to master. I came to learn that the Kasari Rangers are renowned, the cream of the Kasari scouts. Only the raptors, or most accomplished scouts, can enter the advanced training in their remote camps. What comes out of those rites are some of the sneakiest, most intelligent, most observant reconnaissance experts I've seen at war. They are adept at most weapons, but their ability to improvise intelligently is uncanny. Their greatest strength is not their valor, which is profound, but their competence. The Kasari Rangers can do virtually anything you ask them to. Want them to scout a castle, plan an attack, build a siege engine, negotiate, plan a wedding? Prepare for a flood, rescue kittens from trees, carve a tree into furniture, build a house, organize a search party, sail a boat, dance at a ball, write your last will and testament, witness an oath, make milk into cheese, shoe a horse, sing a song, wrestle, change a baby, heal the sick, recite the law, pan for gold, perform a funeral, fletch, fetch, sow, grow. The Kasari Rangers were supposed to be able to do all of that and more. Mage Lord Minilin, called the Spellmonger, Lord of Sevendor, I introduced myself with a bow.
Skortig Gefulgar, Captain Arborn, leader of the Endranar Outpost, emissary of our chief to the Alka'alon, he said, bowing politely himself. I've heard of you, Mage Lord, he added. What have you heard, my good ranger, that you have stirred up the Gavani and spit in the eye of their king?
Not precisely,
I demurred, that you have toppled the old order and made Magi as powerful as dukes.
That's a little closer, I conceded,
that you are a common man raised beyond your station through acts of valor, he continued.
Near the mark, I agreed.
I have not heard of you, I'm afraid. Don't be, he said, chuckling. I am a mere ranger of the Kasari. We do not seek fame or glory. But we watch the passes and the frontiers of our lands, and when we see the Casa Delaine agitating, we would not fail to alert our friends the Alka'alon.
Master Harathel was telling me that the Kasari aided the Alka'alon. I had no idea any Humani were in close contact with them.
It is not generally known, he agreed. Though our peoples are estranged, there are times when our paths cross. The Kasari have been allies of the Alka'alon since the Majocracy. We greatly admire their reverence for the land. Tell me, he said seriously, have you often encountered them?
Apart from a brief time in the refuge of Amadia, directly before the invasion, no, I admitted, although I do have the three emissaries of the Council, Ithalia, Thalawen, and Varen.
Ithalia is known to me, he nodded. And I have heard of Thalawen, of course.
Ah, why, of course?
He looked surprised. Why? She is the heir to Anthatiel, only daughter of Lord Eretas. I thought the fact was well known. That argument has been going on since I was a boy.
Argument?
She defies her father's wishes with her familiarity with our race. He forbade her return to her home until she repents.
He seems a stern Alcan, I agreed. Aratas was no friend to humankind, yet Fallowan the emissary was his daughter? That was interesting. He is a mighty lord, and will not change his heart lightly, Arborne assured me.
Yes, I got that impression. But that is the extent of my knowledge of the treefolk, until I came here.
So, you have not met many others?
Only a few. They are quite memorable, as is this sanctuary.
He smiled serenely. It is a magical place, is it not?
My professional opinion?
Indeed, I said, looking around at the sedate discussions around me. Pentandru was talking to Ithalia and two other Alka Alon, while Lady Verin and an older male Alkan conversed with Lenadara. And Master Guri was speaking to three Alka like they were old friends, a mug in one hand and a fruit in the other.
They are a delightful people, he observed, full of majesty and fury. They are powerful friends, Mage Lord, but bitter enemies. Be wary, he warned.
Here? I dismissed. I've never felt safer.
Do not assume that, he said in a quiet voice. You have enemies you do not know about.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. It seems like everyone wants me dead these days. Anyone in particular? I asked, looking around.
To call it to your attention would not serve you. They do not know you are enemies yet. Pray to Trigg that they do not discover it.
Hidden enemies?
Who do not know they hate me yet, I said, considering the logistics of the matter.
You speak in riddles, Captain.
Scorteag Dibonabi. Sometimes ignorance is the best defense. Trust me, Mage Lord, for you have hidden friends, too.
With that, he walked away, leaving me thoroughly perplexed and expecting assassins to leap out of the shrubbery. Discussion of the war and the sad state of the Elshari Wilderlands I was prepared for. Not enigmatic warnings and shifty glances. Not what I expected from the Kasari Ranger. I needed a drink. The emissary from the Valley people nodded to me, but he didn't look as friendly as the Ranger had. But when you're one of a handful of people in the room over 5 feet tall, you tend to notice each other. Eventually, Fallowan introduced us. Lord Davios barely looked at me, after politely inquiring about my health and family. It was as if he did not consider me completely civilized, and didn't want to be associated with me even in a crowd of non-humans. The Valley people, unlike the Kasari, are highly reclusive and downright xenophobic. It is said that no living man has ever traveled to their secret valley and returned. But the Valley people do occasionally leave their home and live among us. They tend to be absolutely perfect specimens of humanity, the men well-muscled, and the women beautiful and perfectly proportioned. They wore distinctive gauntlets or braces of metal, highly ornate and likely socially meaningful. But little was known about that mysterious realm or the culture of its beautiful people. In truth, we probably knew more about the Alka Alon than the enigmatic Valley people, and Lord Davios was happy to keep it that way. Thankfully, it was not he I was tasked to charm. I made a point of getting some time alone with each of my opponents on the council that evening. I cornered Lord Letheran on the balcony, overlooking the amazingly beautiful river valley. A remarkable place, I commented, trying my best to seem friendly.
One of the last of the old strongholds, the Alcan Lord said gruffly, built as a pleasant refuge from the affairs of the greater realm. Now it stands nearly alone. A pleasant place for exile? He admitted.
I understand your palace is equally remarkable, I said, not really knowing anything of the sort.
My tower? Yes, Master Menelan, it is even more of a testament to the greatness of our past, but it too is but an outpost of our lost greatness.
What makes the past ages great? I wondered aloud. I didn't know what point I was trying to make. I was just talking, trying to engage the Alcan.
What?
They owe jest.
Letheran studied me, as if considering taking offense. He might have been 4 feet tall, but I was sure I couldn't have taken him.
It is a fair question, and honestly asked, I demurred.
For my folk, greatness varies according to who accounts it.
The Majocracy is seen as a great period in our history, but for most of the people it was a time of oppression and low living standards. I merely wish to know how you view greatness, Lord Netheren. What exactly has been lost, my lord?
Lost? The will to shape our own destinies, Master Menelan. The desire to seek more than quiet contemplation, amused by the variations of life. Ambition, then, marks our lost glory. We have none, now. Only in aliens and feral servants do we see any spark of ambition any more.
He sounded bitter. My lord, is that why you dislike my people so?
Your people are ephemeral and unpredictable,
he shot back. They are brash and arrogant, and you typify them. You bring us presents? Great presents they are. I can transport to my home now with a thought, or anywhere else I please. But at what cost? They are novelty, Mage Lord, nothing more. As is your famous snowstone. This is not the first time your folk have offered us gifts, nor would it be the first time those gifts left us entangled in your affairs. What price will we pay this time, I wonder? Not mere Irionite. What price will our culture pay by renewing our association with you?
Only time will tell, I conceded. But if we do not, then Shurul will defeat us one at a time.
I do not fear the abomination or his rabble,
said the haughty Alcan Lord derisively, no more than I would fear your warrior king riding against me.
I hope the day comes when you do fear Shurul as I do, I said quietly. I have no wish to change the way things are between our folk any more than necessary. But if there is not some discourse, we will both fare worse for it.
There are those in my kindred who favor no kind of accommodation with your folk,
he observed thoughtfully.
They ask to what advantage can such intercourse come. I am hard-pressed to answer them.
Perhaps you will all be persuaded by observing our character.
That may not be to your favor, Mage Lord.
I beat a hasty retreat. I knew when I was losing. My meeting with Lord Aratas was more antagonistic. I approached him during the reception and asked him how he was enjoying my gift. He looked down at the pendant shining on his breast and gave a snort.
My loyalties cannot be purchased with pretty baubles, Master Menelan,
he warned. It was not your loyalty I sought to buy. It was your attention. He gave me a steely stare.
Pray you never have it in full, Humani.
A little of it is all I desire, I said, as smoothly as a Remiran tapestry merchant. Surely you share our concerns over the Umbra. Shadow on our mutual frontier does neither of us good.
It challenges you, he pointed out. It challenges your abilities.
It would challenge yours as well, my lord. Was not the Aronin of Amadia a kinsman of yours?
Aye. And his daughter Amaras, my niece, remains missing, he agreed warily, as do many of our young people. But I do not war out of vendetta, like the feral Gavani. My borders are secure, as they have been for 3,000 years. Long before your folk were invited, he said.
It sounded like an indictment from his lips.
I felt myself secure from you until you were at my doorstep. If I have to content myself with two such sorry neighbors, what is the loss?
Lord Aratas was a tough sell, but not completely unreasonable. I just couldn't persuade him.
I admire you personally, Master Menelan,
he finally conceded.
It was well done, relieving our outpost as you did, and the mystery of the snow that never melted is enough to elevate you to some celebrity among our folk.
I hope to explore that more, with your help.
The lives of men are short, he reminded me. What brave deeds you may do today will come to naught in the future, due to your mortality. Only among the valley folk and perhaps the Kasari is there much reliability among the Humani anymore, and even they are no more stable than a clan of Karshak.
So what would you have us do? I asked.
Fight your war, Master Menelan, and do make it entertaining, but do not involve my kindred more than you already have. It is known that you seek allies amongst the youngest of our folk, the rashest among us, he added. I am a pragmatic Alcan, Master Menelan. I know the rebelliousness of youth, and I know the allure of your ephemeral culture among some. Pragmatism says I must tolerate this.
It does not demand I encourage it." With that, he left without a further look. Pure, cold, hard contempt, right down to my human soul. I had been considered and dismissed. It smarted, but then I hadn't really expected better. I sighed and made my way over to our host, Master Harifel.
"An admirable effort, Master Menelan," he said consolingly. "If it eases your mind, there are those who have tried to persuade each of them in lesser matters since the fall of the Majocracy, without as much success."
"Actually, that does make me feel better. Thanks."
"The bribes were a nice touch," he added, laying a finger delicately over his own stone. "They are as you said. They can be used as portable waypoints, regardless of local magical density. That is a power that not even our ancestors possessed. As much as Lord Aratas dislikes your people and Lord Letheran mistrusts them, they are beholden to you for that wonder."
"I hope so," I grumbled. "So how does this council of yours work? A simple vote, or is it a matter of precedence?"
"Things do not work like that here. No one commands, and the council does not govern."
"But I thought it ruled the Alka alone."
"Things do not work like that among my people. This council is deliberative in nature, not executive. We pool our wisdom to exchange information and find consensus. The council has little actual authority. That lies with the individual lords."
"So why have a council at all?"
"Not everything demands action, my young friend," the Alcan smiled. "Some things require action, but only after sufficient contemplation. In this council, the wise can contemplate, exchange views, even argue. But we do not command each other. The proper action usually suggests itself soon enough, once the correct information has been assembled. But oftentimes, the problems clear up of their own accord."
"Sherul is not going to go away on his own," I pointed out. "He doesn't even breathe, let alone age. And if you are counting on the Humani to deal with him, well, we might beat his minions in the field," I admitted. "But once the goblins were cleared away, we still could not match his arcane strength."
"It is a long problem,"
the Master of the Hall said, nodding his head sagely.
"I sympathize, Master Menelan. And yes, Sherul may involve our folk in this matter, should he continue his attacks, but you will not see many of my people move against him hastily. That is not our way. I am among your folk's most devout supporters, but even I cannot counsel taking the field against the abomination. It is too soon, and we know too little. There are other forces to contend with, forces you know nothing about. As grave a threat as Sherul is, we must study it before we can act. That is the essence of wisdom, and that is our way," he repeated.
"I hope we can afford your way," I sighed. "Master Harifel, I cannot express how glad I am that I was able to guest in your fair valley, and I hope some day to return the hospitality. But I cannot help but think that this was a fool's errand."
"On the contrary, my young friend," the scruffy Alcan smiled, "you couldn't be more wrong. This is the first official delegation from the Humani lands in this hall in several of your lifetimes. Only the valley folk and the Kasari have been here in all that time. Your presence has been cherished," he assured me, "a reminder of alliances long past and visions of the future nearly forgotten. This journey has gained you allies, some perhaps more enthusiastic than useful, but allies nonetheless."
"You mentioned the Kasari. Their lands are nearby, I suppose. Why did you invite them here?"
"The Kasari have long been aides of ours,"
Master Harifel informed me.
"They admire our people, and we find them of use from time to time. But the tidings they bring to council are their own. The feral Gavani tribes of the Kulins have been receiving emissaries from the dead god, urging them to swear to him and revolt against your people. And mine."
"That's not good news," I said, feeling faint. "More Gavani coming down from the north and the east would complicate things dramatically. I only knew a little about the strange Kasari people of the Wilderlands, but I knew that they were wicked fighters, especially when defending their sacred groves. If they saw a threat, it was wise to pay heed."
The Gavani in the east seem more reluctant to take up arms, and many are frightened of the undead lord they would swear to, but many others are eager to fight under his banner against human encroachment. The Kasari have been watching their activity. We shall hear their report in full this evening, but we already know the essence. Shirul does indeed seek to broaden his war. Might I propose that the council consider interviewing Gurkhal? I asked. The Gavani prisoner I took at Bhowal was, indeed, the first to look upon their sacred cave. He mentioned some sort of prophecy among his folk. That might have some value in their culture.
That is well reasoned, agreed Harathel, rubbing his chin. It would be wise to at least speak with him. He is still your prisoner?
Well, he is under a trusted guard, but mostly for his own safety. I am having proper quarters prepared for him at Sevendor before I retrieve him.
Let us know when he is prepared to speak to us.
Harathel nodded with quiet eagerness. I know my colleagues left you with an impression that they are unconcerned with the Gavani, he continued quietly, but in fact they do fear our cousins. Few now live who recall the days of their uprisings, but they were impressively destructive, and at the time the Gavani had yet to develop magic of their own.
Now, he said, letting out a sigh, now we fear that we will be the victims of our own folly, as is too often the case. Worse, that we might deserve it for what we have done in the past.
There was one other encounter I had that evening I wasn't prepared for. A young Alcan male caught me out on the terrace, smoking and gazing at the stars, enjoying the delicious sensations the liquor was giving me. Perhaps it was the altitude or the thinness of the air, but the stars seemed vividly close at hand. I was joined shortly by a smaller Alcan, one of the Versarotti. I was starting to be able to tell them apart a little, don't ask me how, who politely asked if he was disturbing me. I welcomed him to share the evening. It was a big terrace.
I am called Cardareth, he said, in flawless Narasi. I have heard much of the great spellmonger Minalan.
A lot of people are talking about me, I nodded. I really don't see what all the fuss is about.
You brought the great gems to the council, he observed. Such magnificence. They throb with arcane force, he said expressively. Have you more such trinkets? He asked almost casually.
But even an Alcan could not disguise his eagerness for the prize. I'm still taking inventory, I admitted, but there might be more.
I have always had a fascination with such things, as do many of my kindred. Considering the danger and potency of the gems, should not a wiser and more knowledgeable mind undertake their study?
It was utterly patronizing. I felt like he was trying to talk a child out of a gold nugget he'd found. I'm a pretty fair thaumaturge myself, I revealed, and I have the Karshak stonesingers to advise me.
Karshak? He asked in disbelief. You put such treasures before the eyes of mere...
I'd advise caution when speaking so of the Karshak, I interrupted, which seemed to irritate him. I've only known them a short time, but they have a temper. Master Guri is here.
Artisans, he dismissed. These wonders deserve proper study by the appropriate scholars, he insisted.
I've attended a magical academy, I assured him. I've got all my parchment in order.
A Humani magic academy? He sneered, hardly the proper authority needed to fathom the depths of such wonders.
And yet that's exactly what I plan, I said coolly. When I need the insights of the Alka Alon, I'm sure that the council will provide the necessary experts.
The council, he scoffed, nearly as bad as a Humani magical academy. Do you have any idea what this snowstone of yours could mean, spellmonger?
I do, I nodded, or at least I know its value. The snowstone is just the beginning. The gems in my collection, I said, shaking my head, purposefully baiting him, there is no way to envision of what they might be capable. I was getting to him, I could tell. Don't ask me why I was teasing him. I'm not usually that cruel to someone I don't know, but this one seemed to inspire me. But the Alka are subtle creatures, and patient. He calmed down soon enough.
At least tell me what you know of its origins, he insisted. That much at least might assist in my research.
It involved the precise moment of the birth of my son, I told him. There was a problem.
Magical, not biological. I used a Morath rune and some creative improvisation to intervene. The next moment, every atom of silica for 2 miles in every direction was transformed into snowstone.
You used the Morath rune?
He asked. I could see him mentally translating the rune into its more complex Alka form.
And it involved your child's birth? Interesting.
I'm sorry I didn't take better notes, I said, refilling my pipe. I was busy at the time.
Notes? Ah, those scraps you scribble on. No matter. The experience is still engraved in your mind. It can be withdrawn easily enough.
That got my attention. I think that might be a lot more trouble than you foresee.
It is a simple enough procedure. My brother Brynfeldin is adept at such songs. He could have the memory out of you.
Not without my permission, I said flatly, and I'm feeling very insecure about my memories at the moment. Mayhap the day will come when such a thing is attempted, but I have truly larger priorities now.
There is no larger priority,
he insisted, getting angry.
Had you the wit to realize it, you would agree? Do you not see? This stone of yours has the potential to save all Kalador. Your petty feud with the Gavani means nothing compared to this.
That is your perspective, I said diplomatically. I do not share it.
We will address this again, he said, tight-lipped. Human birth, you say?
There were other factors at play, I told him grudgingly. The chamber was the intersection of natural nodes of power, for instance. For all I know, the time of day was a factor, or the snowstorm. I'm far more concerned with the result than the mechanism, however.
Yes, the snowstone,
he nodded, his eyes glazed.
And those gems?
No, the lives of my child and my wife, I said flatly. The snowstone was a happy blessing of the spell, but it was merely an enchanted byproduct.
Of course,
he said dismissively.
Has the child exhibited any unusual symptoms?
He's a little colicky, if his mother eats too many legumes, I said, growing more irritated. Other than that, he's a normal human baby.
Interesting,
he nodded. He will reach maturity in only a few years, too. That should prove fascinating to observe. I'm looking forward to it, I said.
Tell me, how much gold would it take for you to part with the child?
He asked. I know you people are mad for gold, he explained. I'm sure we can reach some reasonable arrangement. No amount of gold is going to part me from my son, I said darkly. Indeed, no power on Kalador could do so without earning my wrath, and after my body has fallen, you'd still have to get through his mother. I know you aren't familiar with our culture, I warned, but Humani females are particularly touchy over their offspring.
But you breed them like animals, he declared. Frustrated. You will have many more children with many more females. What matters this one?
I went through a lot to keep him, and I'm not going to part from him. Any further discussion on the subject will give offence, I pointed out to him, as evenly as I could. I started to subconsciously draw power from my sphere when we were interrupted by Master Harathel.
Kadareth,
he said sharply when he saw who I was standing with. What is this? You are forbidden from these proceedings.
I am not in exile,
the younger Alkan pointed out, and then spat out a harsh line of sing-song in his own language. Master Harathel answered him passionately, and then Kadareth bowed his head.
I beg forgiveness if I have given you offence, spellmonger,
he said, not sounding at all apologetic.
I will go now, but we will speak again.
Perhaps, I answered. Hopefully at that time I would have a mage blade handy.
My apologies,
Mage Lord Minelan, Harathel said, after Kadareth had left. He is young and from a troubled house. His diplomacy and tact need work too, I said gruffly.
I have no doubt he made outrageous claims or accusations, or said things that you found troubling,
Harathel sighed. He is unstable. Indeed, his whole line is compromised. His brothers have been exiled, after some trouble they caused with their fanatical views. Kadareth alone was spared that ignominy, due to his young age and his willingness to abide by the council's dictates.
If only such flawed condition was spared the burden of talent, he would be content. But he and his brothers are quite adept.
But with a low opinion of anyone who isn't Alka Allan, I observed.
With a low opinion of anyone who doesn't share their narrow, bigoted perspectives, he corrected. And even then, they war among themselves as much as with everyone else. That is fortunate, for there is a whole faction of them. We call them the Enshadowed now, he said, looking a little guilty.
There must be a story there, I prompted.
For another time, the master decided. It is a dark and unflattering tale, filled with compromises and pointless sacrifice. We face enough ill news in our day. We need not dwell on the darkness of the past to appreciate the light of hope that shines on us now.
There was something in the way he said it that prompted me to ask the question. Cardareth told me that the Snowstone had the possibility of saving Kalador, I said slowly. Was he wrong?
No,
Harathel admitted. No, he was not wrong.
Though perhaps save is too strong a term. Preserve would be a better one. But there is much yet we must study about the substance to be sure, he added with a note of caution.
Something about his manner troubled me. Master, I hear a lot of wistfulness in the Alka Allan, if you don't mind me saying.
We are just beginning to appreciate the light we have left. This crisis has opened more than one old wound, and it promises to inflict many more. Our best course is wisdom. Let us proceed with open minds and open hearts, with hope as our beacon. That may be the only way out of this crisis.
Chapter 5. The Findings of the Council. I made the rounds of all five great lords that night. None of them seemed particularly anxious to be persuaded to give me what I needed, I thought. But they were all quite gracious when it came to the gifts of the enchanted Apophyllite. As they never seemed to tire of demonstrating, the necklaces gave them the ability to enter their magical net of transport spells nearly at will, and it greatly improved the responsiveness of their song spells. What they didn't know was that I had six more of them, though not so large or prettily set, and that was just the beginning. My secret chamber in the side of the mountain had a whole table laid out with the raw stones Master Guri's best gem singers had retrieved from deep under the mountain. I wasn't exactly sure what I would do with them. A lot of that would depend upon the council's response to my request. While we waited, we took full advantage of the place. It was beautiful, after all, and there were plenty of things to see and do and experience. Meals were always on time and delicious, though the lack of meat in them was interesting. A certain indefinable nuttiness seemed to permeate all of the Alka Allan's food, nor were our other needs ignored. There always seemed to be an Alka attendant waiting discreetly for us, just around the corner, ready to fetch us anything we desired. I was given a special tour of one hall by Lady Athalia, who thought I might appreciate it. Inside were artifacts and such from the earthly magocracy, gifts given the master of the hall in ages past. Most were amusing trinkets to the Alka Allan, but they had a much different effect on me.
This is a model of Perwin, I said, startled when I saw it.
It was about 6 feet long and 3 wide, but I recognized the general shape and geography.
Yes, from its earliest days, she agreed, before your great cities were built, before your people's Rajira awakened.
It seems so small, I said, looking at the dusty old thing.
It suited their purposes. Just over 200,000 square miles. They needed a base of operations for the task of seeding the mainland. Perwin was ideally situated, a good mix of arable land and natural resources, situated to all human settlements.
And then we sank it, I pronounced. Just like us. We just can't have nice things.
What is this? This was the cask the first of your gifts of trees arrived within, she said happily. These are conifers, I believe.
Trees, of course. That would be the route to your kindred's heart. She smiled.
This was a gift from your gods, she said casually, opening a box, to thank us for our help in evacuating Perwin. Blood coral,
she said reverently, displaying about a pound and a half of it. That got my attention. Blood coral is almost as mythical as Irionite. Blood coral was fascinating stuff, thaumaturgically. If you placed a drop of blood on it, it would recognize you, which made it useful for all sorts of enchantments. Like knot coral and other seaborne magical components, only the sea folk traded in it, and the price was very high.
Antir, your sea god, bore it here when the last of the peaks sunk beneath the waves.
Antir is an imperial maritime god, I corrected. My ancestors were horse lords.
I am still learning the variations of your cultures. All the same, it was a noble gift.
She nodded. So the gods have been here. Some of them.
The gods,
she began, and then stopped.
That is a complex subject.
I wouldn't expect any less from them, but this gift implies that they have been here. Physically.
The fact that they can manifest as independent beings is one of the hallmarks of your race.
You seem to know a lot about the subject.
Just some family lore,
she dismissed. I heard you were speaking with Cardareth last evening. That sorry little twerp. Yes, he offered to purchase my son. Her eyes bulged.
He... what?
Minalian. He offered to buy him from me for research purposes. He offered me a lot of gold.
Mage Lord, I am appalled. No ignorance of culture excuses such callousness. To invite a father to sell his child. That violates every rule of hospitality. He knows better.
Calm down, I didn't sell him. And to be frank, there are plenty of men in the world who would have taken up that bargain. But it begs the question of just how important Minalian is. I know his birth was profound, I began, but he hasn't shown any other signs of being remarkable. He's a normal human baby.
I know,
Ithalia said.
I have examined him, with his mother's permission.
You... what?
Merely a cursory examination while you were absent, Mage Lord, I assure you.
Akin to the scans you do when you are worried about something.
You are correct. He is a normal Humani boy in every way.
Then why was Cardareth so interested in collecting him?
Because that idiot's fascination with Snowstone has eclipsed what little decency he had. He is convinced that Snowstone... well, he deeply desires learning its secrets, she finished. Particularly its origins. He feels it will prove some pet theories of his, but it is all the more galling to him that it was a Humani discovery. He and his faction have little regard for your race.
I got that impression.
Did he mention his brother at all?
She asked curiously. Only in passing. Why?
His whole family is touched with this fanaticism, she said after a moment's thought. He alone was spared exile from civilized realms because of his youth and brilliance, and the intercession of some distant family. If they were to learn of your recent fortunes, they might seize the opportunity to take what they wish by force. Cardareth alone is incapable of such maneuverings, but his faction and his family would not hesitate to act.
They'll have a fun time of it, then, I chuckled. Sevendor is no longer lightly guarded.
It is by our standards,
she objected.
That is one thing that my fellow emissaries and I have petitioned the council over. We feel that Sevendor is too valuable to be left unguarded. We have asked for permission to augment your defenses against such misguided actions.
Well, I wouldn't refuse the additional protection, I said, as we left the hall. But I would want to be in control of those defenses.
Of course, Mage Lord,
Ithalia agreed.
The desire is to protect you, not take control of the mountain. Indeed, your possession of it may have forestalled argument over its disposition among the members of the council. As a Humani, you present a neutral force in their discussions.
I'm not neutral, I corrected. I have my own agenda.
As do they,
she said simply. I was told Lord Aretas is the father of Lady Fallowen, I said. She stopped walking abruptly.
That is true,
she acknowledged warily. As such, is there any influence she could use on my behalf?
I doubt that any word from Fallowen would sway her father, she said after consideration. The Lord of the Lake City is stubborn and proud and set in his ways.
They are all but estranged.
Just a thought. You don't have any influential relatives around here, do you?
No, Mage Lord,
she assured me. None of my kin have standing at this council. I don't know if it was shame, pride, or some secret motivation, but I could tell my questions had disturbed her. She made an excuse and departed soon thereafter. I can't tell you much else about that day, because it passed in a blurry haze of contentment. I saw wonders there. Sculpture, plants, animals I'd never seen, and magic, the purpose of which I had only the vaguest notion. The night was filled with feasting and song in the Hall of Hospitality. It was more casual than the previous day's reception, and everyone was invited to participate with a tale or a song. I even goaded Pentandra to play a bit on the lute, and got Dara to sing. I tried to keep Guri quiet. The voices of the Karshak are best for shouting, not singing. We were all summoned to council the next morning, where the decisions reached after 2 days' internal discussions, reports, deliberations, and considerations were finally announced. The chamber was full of Alka Alon, many representatives of refuges and settlements near the penumbra, some further out. Nor were we the only human beings present. I spied both the tall, aggressively handsome ranger captain, Arborn, and the envoy of the valley folk was standing nearby. He certainly looked like a valley folk man was supposed to. Piercing grey eyes, rich, luxuriant hair, and arms the size of anvils, covered with mighty bronze braces. Between the two of them I felt positively girly. But our attention was upon our host, Master Harothel, who spoke for the council from the beginning. He first addressed his people in his own tongue, then spoke Narasi for our benefit.
"It is the decision of this council," Master Harothel said slowly, "that the threat in the east, the Kulnuara known as Shurul, is a real and authentic danger to these lands. The abomination wrought by the feral Gavani and the armies that it in turn created threaten everyone in the realm. The shadow that has been unleashed by the Gavani is potent. It may be beyond the power of the Council to defeat, and its domain remains a threat to both Alka Alon and the other races."
Nice of them to agree on that, Pentandra told me mind to mind. They had to agree that there was a threat before they could agree what to do about it, I noted. No one is immune from bureaucratic procedure.
It is therefore the decision of the Council to take appropriate action. Since they cannot be protected, the refuges east of the Pearwoods will continue to be evacuated, he directed. Those displaced will be relocated to more secure strongholds, where possible. We will be hard-pressed to find room for them all, but we cannot risk our folk falling prey to the dark priests of the abomination. Secondly, the nature and disposition of these dark lands shall be investigated. No direct action will be taken against it until it is more completely understood. For this, we will designate our agents and call upon the skills of our Kasari friends. He nodded toward the ranger and then turned to me. As much as our Humani allies would appreciate a robust intervention, he said, looking pointedly at me, interference without understanding invites catastrophe in this instance. We will proceed cautiously.
That wasn't particularly good news. If the goblins decided to invade southern Gilmora this summer, but cautious interest was better than apathy, I consoled myself.
Thirdly, Master Minolan shall be allowed to retain his Irianite sphere. He has demonstrated his responsibility with his powers, and has acted with wisdom and restraint. Further, he is named a friend of the Council, as our liaison with the new Humani Kingdom. His request for assistance will be met, and we will continue to exchange information and lend what assistance we can, in a limited way.
That was also lukewarm news. I knew the Council was toying with the bad idea of trying to take my sphere away, and hearing that they would not make the attempt was gratifying. Being a friend of the Council was nice, I supposed, but being the liaison between the Kingdom and the Council sounded like far too much work. Not that I had a choice in the matter, but the weight of the additional responsibility was not welcome, even if the sentiment was.
Fourth, in pursuit of this cause, the Council has decided to allow a very limited use of transgenic magics
to facilitate communication and the sharing of knowledge between our two peoples, and also to assist in the investigation of the region your folk call the Umbra. In return, Master Menelan will agree to facilitate research into the nature and origin of Snowstone.
That was also an expected development. I was pretty curious about the Snowstone spell myself, of course, but it did not seem that important to me, considering the goblin threat. The Alka-Alon apparently have different priorities. But if they put a value on asking me questions about my wife's labor and delivery, I wasn't going to leave the coin on the table. Besides, there was a very high likelihood that we'd learn something useful out of it.
Fifth, we ask that the Gavan known as Gurkarl, who has some special destiny according to the feral Gavani's native prophecy, shall be brought before us for examination and discussion,
Master Harathel said, his eyes fixing on me again. I nodded.
Sixth, in light of the chaos of the moment, a company shall be formed and expedition shall be sent to investigate the whereabouts of Amaras, daughter of the Aronin of Amadia, and other missing Alka-Alon. In this, we may ask for Humani aid at need and look to Mage Lord Minelan to facilitate that. Lastly, all of the settlements and refuges in the realm shall be guarded and alert against the menace posed by the abomination. The wandering company shall be recalled, the nurseries and arbor shall be abandoned for now as a precaution against attack. Thus has the council decided, he intoned, and then went back to lecturing everyone else in Alka-Alon.
That went better than I expected, Pentandra admitted, while he droned on. It was nearly everything we wanted, I agreed. I still can't help but think they were holding back.
Of course they are. But we've established ourselves as a player at the table. That's worth a lot right there. They're taking us seriously.
We'll see. There was a lot more to it. The council had apparently ruled on dozens of cases. Suddenly I realized what it must feel like to be in my own court as a plaintiff or defendant. I wondered idly if they were bored and if their little asses hurt. I didn't understand a tithe of what was decided, as most of it had to do with the internal workings of the tree folk refuges. But there were a few names that caught my attention.
On Ranion to be released on his own responsibility, after questioning by the council, and dispatched to Lesgathiel at the council's behest for scholarship and assistance. Randior to be...
That name, I said out loud.
What name?
Pentandra asked. On Ranion, I said. I know that name. And they said Lesgathiel.
Who is Onranion?
She asked, one eyebrow arched. He's the one who made my witch sphere, I informed her. I met him the same time I met Ithalia.
I hate that name,
Pentandra remarked. We've got to come up with something else.
Regardless, he took three pieces of Irionite and made it one, then laced it with powerful Alka-Alon song spells.
I reached out and tapped Ithalia on the shoulder.
Is that the same?
She nodded.
Master Onranion, the Songmaster, has been detailed to work with us at Lesgathiel and study Snowstone. Is that a problem, Mage Lord?
Not at all, I smiled. I like the old coot. He has a mischievous streak.
That is what earned him an inquiry from the Council,
she reminded me.
His character is suited to considering such novelties. He is pleased with the appointment. He looks forward to studying Snowstone, despite his poor grace among some on the council. Some wished to see him sanctioned, not rewarded, if not exiled outright.
I know, but he's a good fellow. He did that, knowing it would get him into trouble.
He was very grateful for your assistance, Mage Lord, and sought to demonstrate that with the gift. I trust you have not used it often?
No, I admitted. I guess I'm uneasy about using it without proper Alka-Alon supervision. But I suppose he would qualify. If the council let me keep my sphere, then they can't really complain if I use it.
There are others who might object,
she said uneasily. What did he call them? The Enshadowed? I wouldn't let their opinions decide whether or not I'd pursue a promising line of research, Lady Ithalia, especially if it could save Gilmora. Besides, I've got every other kind of fanatic out there after me already. A few more won't hurt.
Your boldness does you credit, Mage Lord,
she said quietly. Master Harothel gave one last public goodbye before closing the council, thanking the participants, praising his staff, and inviting the principals back in a year's time to reconvene. Then we broke up. Pentandra said a lengthy goodbye to Arborn, the ranger captain, and my Alka-Alon emissaries collected our party in short order, with the addition of Onranian. The old